Breaking Banks Asia is brought to you today by Kamakura Co.
There are known knowns. There are things we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know. But there are also unknown unknowns. The ones we don't know, we don't know.
As has been pointed out, when you think of good defense strategies, you try to be aware of all the possibilities, including the unknown unknowns. If your business needs to be certain of the things you think you know, able to get clear answers to the things you don't know, and can quickly discover the important things you didn't even know you didn't know, then you probably need CRIS, the Kamakura Risk Information Service. CRIS provides real-time intelligence on business conditions across 68 countries, honing from 39,000 probabilities, each with exposures ranging from 30 days to 10 years. CRIS is used to manage exposures, identify trends, and see opportunities. And CRIS is the leading global service to ensure that you know what you need to know and can anticipate and see around the corner to see some of the things you didn't know you didn't know. If you want to know more, send an email to BBA for Breaking Banks Asia at Kamakuraco, KamakuraCo.com. BBA at KamakuraCo.com and learn more about CRIS and how Kamakura can help you. FinTech, or financial technology, is changing everything about the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Welcome to Breaking Banks Asia, the podcast dedicated to exploring how this disruption is affecting the Asia-Pacific area. Here is your host, Simon Spencer.
All right, well, welcome to Breaking Banks Asia. I'm Simon Spencer, your host tonight. I wanted to call out some interesting conferences that are coming up. Sydney has a really interesting conference coming up that I thought was worth calling out. It's the Sydney Millennial 2020 Summit, November 14th and 15th. There's a really interesting selection of non-fintech and fintech businesses there. You've obviously got Facebook, The Iconic, Airbnb, Sendal, but you've also got CBA and Westpac there. So I think it's a really interesting space to go to understand the perspective from the millennial. We also obviously have Hong Kong Finovate in November, November 7th and 8th. And also, I wanted to call out the regional conference out at Geelong, the Pivot Summit. Geelong is a really interesting place to watch. You know, the work they're doing in carbon fiber, the work that's coming out of Deakin University, the transformation that's happening there is quite remarkable. So the Pivot Summit, it's very much focusing on emerging technologies, use of new manufacturing techniques, but also there's definitely a Breaking Banks angle there as well. To enter the competition to get a ticket to Finovate Asia in Hong Kong, what I want you to do is follow our Twitter address for Breaking Banks Asia, which is BBanksAsia. And I want you to follow and do a tweet. And if you're interested in actually going to Finovate, then include the hashtag BBA in your tweet. Obviously, make sure you're available to travel in November. And I'll pick two winners to get a free ticket to Finovate in Hong Kong. So I'm joined today by Jason Potts, Professor of Economics in the School of Economics, Finance and Marketing at RMIT University. He's also the director of the Blockchain Innovation Hub, the first social science research institute of blockchain in the world. So Jason, welcome to Breaking Banks.
Thank you, Simon. It's good to be here.
So look, blockchain, we could talk about this for a very long time. It's clearly a very exciting area. What's your thought of blockchain? Is it overhyped at this stage?
No, I don't think it is. My perspective on this is someone who spent a lot of time, my career is studying the economics of new technologies. This is what I do, is I study new technologies. And this is one that I think is actually weirdly underhyped at this stage. It's the transformative potential here is far beyond what a lot of people are seeing initially as cryptocurrency and money and payments. That's just the beginning. And it's hard to imagine what comes after this. So people are sort of getting excited about this as a potential bubble in this one thing. But I'm extremely bullish on where this goes.
Now, I've read some of your work, and there was one thing I really wanted to understand is, what is crypto economics? It's a wonderful word. Yeah. What does it mean?
Yeah, so crypto economics, it's an interesting concept. So the thing about how blockchains work is that they're essentially a validation technology. And how they work is counterintuitively, for something that's based on cryptography, they don't use cryptography to provide the security. They use economic incentives to provide the security. The crypto part of cryptocurrencies is in the hashing functions, which are essentially to spread the computation. So what crypto economics is focusing on how you design incentives into blockchains to make them secure. And secure means that they can, that they're Byzantine fault tolerant or some mechanism like that. But in essence, crypto economics is taking economic theory, game theory, and the design mechanism design, and applying it to the computational problem of designing protocols.
Now, this is in some ways somewhat something new, because when people have talked about blockchain before, they've mostly fixated on notions of Bitcoin and the currency element of it. The sort of economic implications of blockchain and this notion of decentralization, seems to be something that people are becoming more aware of now.
Yeah, so in a sense, this is the main story here. So the key technology is blockchain. The first application of this is putting money on blockchains that gives you cryptocurrencies. Now, these are native to the way in which blockchains work. And the economic application of that is in money and payments, and that's what we're seeing right now. To all practical purposes, the main use case right now is as a money, as a payments technology. But that's just the beginning. So once you can put money on blockchains, you realize you can actually put anything that is a digital asset on a blockchain. And the next step for this is to realize that it's actually not even digital assets, it's digital. Any assets that can be digitized can go on the blockchain. And then you realize actually it's anything that is a transaction in an economy that has an underlying digital record, which is basically everything, can go on the blockchain. And once you see that essentially this potential, the scale of this technological innovation here is that it could potentially move into very large parts of the economy, and that's the sort of key reason why this is interesting. The centralization decentralization part of this story is also part of this, because the way in which we think of markets and transactions and so on in an economy is largely decentralized. They're peer to peer, in other words, I trade with you, you trade with me, we trade with someone else, and the centralization part of a market economy is actually in the record keeping and clearing of that. We still have to go through the bank or go through some sort of centralized agency to do the underlying clearing of or settlement of these contracts. What's just happened is that a market economy, which is largely a decentralized economic system, has always been built on top of a centralized clearing system. So if you think of it this way, what a blockchain actually is it's a technology that facilitates the creation of a decentralized economy and decentralized computation and record keeping. That's what's going on.
So that's very disruptive if you're one of the large institutions, whether you're a government or whether you're a bank, or because your role in the economy shifts in that sort of model, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think this is inevitable.
Do you see notions of labour and how you earn income and people broadly put these things under the umbrella of future of work? Do you see that blockchain is disruptive in that space, or an enabling technology in that space as well?
Yeah. So this is one of the things that I think people haven't begun to think seriously about yet, but it is actually possibly the most disruptive aspect of this technology. And how at the blockchain innovation hub, I mean, we're a bunch of economists who specialize in economic history and technological change, and how we've been thinking about this is what this looks most like is essentially painting the long 20th century as an unusual aberration. And it was a period of the financialization of economic systems where scale economies worked to gather large amounts of finance together to fund large investment projects and therefore large organizations to manage those, which tended to skew towards a particular type of economic reward and organizational structure. What blockchain technologies potentially shift is that they make intellectual property a lot more important, just simply because with lower transactions costs in terms of payments, with lower transactions costs in terms of ability to monitor who's using what and licensing and so on, the long tail of intellectual property gets a lot stronger here. So we can affect, you know, intellectual property only really works for large organizations or for fairly big players. So superstar musicians use it well, superstar books, authors use it well, smaller players don't, which means that a lot of people's human capital and ability to earn income pivoted towards their ability to contract with a large organization, which would take care of all that stuff. I think that's where the new world, the new type of economy we're about to enter into, is one where skilled human capital will find it economically advantageous to effectively be self-contracting, to work a lot more themselves, to partner up with those when they need to. They'll use smart contract organizations and other governance mechanisms to form contracts to do joint projects with people who could be anywhere in the world. These things could be short-term, long-term, multiple layers of these. And at the same time that enormous empowering of individual ability, individual skilled ability to specialize and skilled ability to contract, at the same time you're seeing this sort of hollowing out of these large intermediary roles of organizations. Now, what does that look like? In a weird sort of way, we have seen this before. This was the period just before the Industrial Revolution in Europe. This was the 17th century, but the 17th century in terms of warring kingdoms in Europe and lots of skilled artisans just traveling around. If one king annoyed them, they'd just move on to the next. And what was striking about that world was that these were the people that became the middle classes of capitalism.
And they didn't have the reputation economy per se, but they had mechanisms to manage reputations. Your family, where you came from, and that reputation was very tightly coupled with your ability to find work.
Absolutely. So they took that with them. A lot of sort of clubs and societies and sort of things like would help them to carry that. So they had all of that, but they just didn't have the technology to do this.
So there's something vaguely medieval about blockchain. Well, there you go. You heard it first on Breaking Banks.
Medieval, but without all the bad bits, without all the plagues and wars and so on. But, I mean, what's significant about this is we actually think that this looks like the end of financial capitalism as we know it and entering into a world which is basically far more centered on labor, skilled labor, being able to freely contract globally, and to do so in ways that could be actually quite complex.
It's a really interesting time for lots of reasons. And so you have the emergence of a really interesting technology. You have the emergence of large data assets, machine learning, the development of artificial intelligence systems. And then you have also shifts in employment and moves to freelancing and portfolio-style employment. And so it's hard not to sort of draw some dots and connect some of these things together. And the question I would put to you is how ready are institutions or regulators for this very different landscape?
I think in a lot of ways they're unprepared. And some are responding better than others. So when you look at the ones who are responding well, and I'd put the UK on this, Singapore, Australia is definitely in this box, Canada, what they all have in common is that they're seeing this as global competition. They're seeing this as a situation where they're not just moving to try and develop institutions for their nation state, because this very notion of a nation state is precisely what's under threat here. They're seeing themselves as positioning a regulatory infrastructure and environment and supporting mechanisms, all of which need to be there. for reasons I'll come to in a second, in a way that recognizes that this is a fantastically globally mobile resource and technology. If you annoy it in one place, it's not going to stay and complain, it'll just move somewhere else. And we're observing that in real time with the shutting down of exchanges in China, for example. Uh-huh. They're barely even registered on a lot of the price indices. It just reopened in Japan the next day.
So you would suggest that, you know, blocking Bitcoin or banning Bitcoin or shutting down and preventing ICOs and things like that is not the answer. It's you know, there's obviously some need for some sort of regulation, though.
Yeah, so China is interesting because they came down fairly hard and outright banned ICOs for reasons that are, my understanding is that this had a lot to do with some fraud and just some real serious problems that we're having on the side. So it's possibly an overreaction. But the value of regulation here is interesting. So if you think about why would a firm want to be regulated in this situation? You'd think that all regulation is harmful, for at least from the perspective of firms, and it's meant to benefit consumers. But the firm has a problem, and in this space with an experimental new technology, this problem is heightened. Essentially, the problem the firm has is how to establish credibility with potential investors and customers. How do you know I'm good? How do you know I'm honest? Right. So one thing that you can do to prove that you're good and honest and that you're worth investing in or worth becoming a customer of is you can do something hard that only an honest, valid, sincere company could do. I mean, this is called the promoter's problem in finance. Now, regulation is one way of doing this. You can think of regulation as not actually there to benefit consumers and stop them from exposing them to fraud, but actually a way to benefit firms to enable them to differentiate themselves from potentially fraudulent firms. So, you know, in this sense, that is actually a legitimate role for the state to have actually fairly high standards in this space. It's not a race. A race to the bottom is unlikely to occur, I think, precisely for this reason. What we're likely to see is that regions with tough regulations, but a reputation for them being fair and uncorrupt and scrupulous, will be exactly the sort of regulatory environment that will both attract honest firms to issue securities there and to base their operations there. But it also becomes a signal to other potential contractors and the people interacting with them.
So do you see a scenario, though, where some jurisdictions go for sort of that a very high standard, but whereas others potentially do say, well, we'll actually be a little bit more like the Wild Wild West, mm-hmm. and we will become perhaps the clearinghouse for or the environment for the much more speculative types of transactions? Do you see that happening?
Or yes. So, I mean, that's happening already. So what's interesting is you look at which hubs are very good at this. So Singapore is emerging as a global hub for blockchain technologies, just as it did for intellectual property, for the same reasons. Yep. Singapore has a reputation for having just a very high quality public service. Because of that, they can actually impose quite high standards and know that those standards are credible. And whereas other countries, if you don't have that reputation for a high quality, uncorruptible public service, you just can't play in that game in the first place.
Yep. What roles do you see the banks should be playing in the commercialization of blockchain-based technologies and blockchain-based solutions? You know, what role do they play?
Well, that's a complex one. How I see this playing out is that there's going to have to be a lot of reinvention. And just as, you know, different generations of computers, when we went from mainframes to you know, mini computers and then PCs and so on, there was some shift in the underlying company. Some just disappeared and we never saw them again because they'd specialized in one generation. There are some that managed to survive all the way through by just continually reinventing themselves. So, I mean, IBM is a good example where at the end they actually stopped being a computer company. They're essentially a consultancy now. The same process is likely to play out with banks, that this is, they're going to need to reinvent themselves. But, you know, as organizations, there's a lot of talent in these banks.
If you were to grab the Breaking Banks crystal ball, what sort of time horizon would you be thinking? You know, is this a 2 or 5 or 10 year?
That's a terrifying question.
Oh, it is.
Yeah, so there's a few strategies that can unfold here. I mean, one of them, which you're seeing already, is essentially the same thing that you observe in Silicon Valley with companies like Google, which is they basically become a huge holding company that just buys technology and integrates it and develops and essentially specializes in spotting talent, buying it up, rolling it into its platform. Now, a lot of banks are in a good position to do that. You know, they've got a lot of customers. They've got a lot of ability to absorb new technologies and roll them out. So, you know, in a sense, that world could actually be not that disruptive in the sense we'd still see the same sort of, you know, four pillars in Australia, you know, the same sort of relatively small number of very large banks. It's just what they're doing will change. The other scenario is that, you know, think, what is a bank? A bank is actually regulatorily defined as a sort of a deposit-taking institution that has these particular properties, right? So it's defined as a thing in law based upon some criteria of financial architecture that made sense 300 years ago. Another possibility is that this function of banking, or moving money around, or moving financial assets around and keeping track of that, might be done by very, very different types of organizations. The obvious ones would be just anything that is in the social media space, for example.
So Facebook, Apple, Google.
Yeah, all right. So, I mean, you know, a blockchain is...
This isn't the ABC, we can name brands.
Okay. All right. So, I mean, yeah, a blockchain is a peer-to-peer network for moving digital assets around, right? That's not that different to a social network.
So basically, any of the large sort of fabric or platform providers on that scale could play in this space and then use a bank backend.
Yeah. Well, they'll use a bank backend to deal with the regulatory aspects of this, or the client-facing aspects of this.
But the sexy stuff is all done by someone else.
Yeah. So, yeah, it remains to be seen where the value added...
That must be a bit of a nightmare scenario for some banks.
I would hate to be in the C-suite of many of these things right now. But this is also a really enormous opportunity for banks for essentially the leaderboard to shift around.
Is there a bit of a sort of prisoner's dilemma? Yeah. So the classic prisoner's dilemma is you get, say, four people in a room, and so long as they all agree, that they'll tend to get off. But if one of them blinks, then the other three are in real trouble. And the prisoner's dilemma, you know, if you apply this to sort of this world, is, you know, is there an opportunity for a bank to, and it may not be one of the you know, it could be a bank anywhere in the region or anywhere in the world, that decides it's going to be on the front foot, it will collaborate effectively with the startup community and really start to create that future. And if it does so, then, you know, the prisoner's dilemma logic kicks in, and it has a definite advantage over the incumbents who perhaps hold on to their traditional models for perhaps a little too long. Do you see that as a dynamic here?
Yeah, I see that as the only dynamic that's playing out here. I mean, the one you just described at the end was essentially the Kodak story, where you just have such leadership that you see yourself as unassailable. I mean, the thing about this technology is this is not like technologies we've seen before, where it's essentially one that you just plug in, it adds productivity to your existing business model. This is an institutional technology that disrupts the very underlying logic of how transactions are working and how organizations are working. So what that means is that this disrupts business models quite fundamentally. You know, this question of what are these various cryptocurrencies worth, and part of the froth in that is that we don't know what the new business models are going to look like. And the only way we figure them out is you try different ones and see what works.
It's an observation that some of the banks in the region have hired some absolutely brilliant people, and a few of them actually have said they're going to come on Breaking Banks, which is great. because they're fully aware of this dilemma, and they're fully aware of the need to be able to disrupt yourself. And it's a question of how do you transition? How do you transition from an old model into a new model, but you don't yet know what that new model even looks like yet? And what's more, in the old world, you built that model yourself, or maybe you inherited it from history. But in the new model, that is going to be built by many people. You'll have a role in it. It'll be built by some startups. It'll be built in open source. It'll be built by some of your competitors will define it. And it'll be about how do you play in a very different landscape to which you contribute.
Like an example of this process is the US auto industry. So I mean, one of the things about being a large, successful organization with a very locked-in business model that you're very efficiently adapted to is, you know, to say it's very hard to change that, but you've got another option. You can essentially define that business model into law. So you can seek regulatory protection to essentially say if you do anything substantially different to this, you're violating, you know, some, you know, particular regulation. So you can lobby, right? You can seek to politically entrench your industry.
You can try to defend your status quo.
Yeah, that can work. It's an investment. You spend money on the lobbying. You get the regulatory protection. It can work for a few years. It can work until your, you know, until your particular term as CEO is over. You can hold off those particular shareholders. But the U.S. auto industry is a classic example of what happens when you do this. Eventually, Elon Musk and his a guy out of tech comes in, completely
reinvents
the car industry, and no one in Detroit has yet responded to that.
Yes,
just simply because they went down the regulatory
path. It's interesting, actually, in the auto industry, some of the most interesting innovations certainly were led by Tesla. But actually, we're now seeing a number of car manufacturers take that IP and some of those ideas from Tesla and commercialize it themselves. And, you know, Elon's famous for having published his various patents and opened them up and open source. And so I think he recognized that in order to create a new industry, he needed to open source it to some extent and get collaboration from people who were his competitors and rivals and in many cases had made things very difficult for him. So I think that is an interesting template to then apply to the fintech world. And the question is how do the banks collaborate effectively, collaborate with their competitors, collaborate with startups? How do they leverage technologies that they don't have full control over?
Yeah, so this is sort of open source software development model issue. The very reason that we got interested in studying blockchain in the first place was that we're studying early stage innovation collaboration, right? Essentially what happens in the very early stage of a new technology. The reason we got just absolutely obsessed with blockchain was that it's such a good example of open source building of a new technology. We've effectively got a lot of people who don't even have never met each other. And we're collaborating, pooling information. It was essentially R&D, a large scale R&D without corporate organization. That was essentially the first. To this day, in many ways, that is the business model for this technological development. That's fairly normal in software. So what we're seeing then is this clash of organizational cultures, of how you build and how you share and how you collaborate. Again, some firms will be better at this than others. Mm. And some of the sort of processes of change management and consultants coming in and trying to help reinvent existing banks, part of what they'll be trying to do is to really re-engineer a lot of these attitudes.
And if you were to sort of speculate as to what are the characteristics of a company that is likely to thrive, I would have thought you'd be suggesting questions of openness and agility and cultural dynamics, its ability to experiment, its ability to partner effectively, and perhaps also its willingness to reinvent itself and disrupt itself. Yeah. And if it can have that sort of DNA, then it can morph and take advantage of some of these emerging models that are going to be played. If, on the other hand, you see a culture of an organization that is very locked down, very silo-driven, very entrenched around traditional products and services, very much focused around let's be a fast follower, but let's get the fundamentals right, where, you know, they might say, you know, trot out phrases like we're risk-averse, then you have to probably raise questions of, you know, are they going to be able to reinvent themselves in time?
Yeah, I mean, I'd be worried about it. I mean, I think, Han, you're absolutely right. What's important to recognise is the ones that, the second set that you described, the ones that are sort of risk-averse, and they're also the ones that are probably quite profitable because they're efficient.
Yes.
They're machines. They're working well. They're not making mistakes.
The shareholders like them.
Shareholders love them. The markets love them. They're the ones I'd be most worried about right now.
No, I think it's going to be a very interesting few years across the region. I've got a number of banks in mind who I think fit into both categories, both. I think it's an exciting time ahead.
Absolutely.
I wanted to ask you a question about ICOs. If you haven't had a thought on that, a few years ago there was we had a huge boom in IPOs, and then obviously a correction. Then we've had a lot of conversations around equity crowdfunding, and here in Australia we've had several waves of legislation come through around equity crowdfunding, and I think there was some degree of criticisms around the first attempt at that, but I think it's definitely going in the right direction. So from crowdfunding, from IPOs to crowdfunding, and now we've got this new phenomenon of an ICO. Have you had much exposure to that area?
Yeah, we've been thinking a lot about this. This is particularly fascinating. So first of all, I think initial coin offering, ICOs, is a particularly unfortunate phrase that's been used here. The reason is it's made to sound like just like an IPO, an equity issue, but faster or but better or but somehow legally lighter. And that's not really what it is. In one sense, it's closer to crowdfunding in its DNA, in the sense that it's you're basically seeking money from a group of people directly and giving them a stake without going through all of the standard rigmarole. And that's normally where the discussion stops. Is this more like crowdfunding, or do we regulate it like an IPO? And in one sense, as I said earlier in a conversation, there is a strong argument to regulate these quite strongly like IPOs, precisely to deal with the promoter's problem. That a good, honest firm seeking investors has a problem with how do they distinguish themselves from the fraudsters. Right? So the high hurdle, high regulatory environment. So there's one thing, right? But the other thing is that the thing that this enables is actually a very different business model. I sort of think of this as tokenized equity raising, because what you're issuing isn't a share. What you're issuing is a token.
Uh-huh.
And a token does stuff that a share doesn't. If you think of it as just a claim on some share of the company's future earnings, in the sense that it's just like or essentially replicating in digital form a piece of equity, fine, it can be that. But that's a very stripped down version of what a token can actually be. A token can be a lot more programmable. You can build in all sorts of contingent contracts and futures markets and connect these to basically build a lot more interesting financial capabilities into that token. It can also be used as a payments mechanism within it.
Is there a retail play there? Like, do you see a scenario where to be a customer of a company, to buy from Coles or so forth, you also potentially participate in the crowdfunding of something?
That door has just opened. 2017 has been the year of initial coin offerings. That was a thing that didn't exist last year. Now it's a big thing. What's not going to happen is we're just going to bed that down and regulate it, and on it will go. I think what the next phase of this is, we'll realize that this is actually a whole new animal that's just been invented. And it's got a lot of capabilities that we haven't even begun to explore yet. Why crowdfund? The value of crowdfunding, and crowdfunding emerged in sort of the film industry and other creative industries first, was crowdfunding gives you a way to measure consumer demand before you've produced a product. It's a really interesting way of actually doing essentially market testing. I think we're just at the beginning of the exploring the possibilities that this new technology of funding corporation.
So what's next for the RMIT Innovation Hub around blockchain?
Well, at the moment, I mean, we're literally a month old. So there's...
Congratulations.
Thank you. There's six of us now, and as soon as our next hiring, posting job ads soon, there'll be another six of us. There's a few things we're doing. One is we're offering up courses to introduce people to the crypto economy. and to provide certification in this space. Another thing we want to do is we're calling this the blockchain observatory. We want to measure this how this is unfolding across the economy. So we'll be setting up an observatory here. We're doing a lot of work around sort of advising government. But the other big thing we'll be doing is application domains around particular industry problems. So the first two that we want to focus on are identity, digital identity, and markets, particularly energy markets, water markets, essentially markets created by government that are often have a lot of friction in them, and to see how we can use blockchain technologies to improve market design in this space.
Excellent. Thank you so much for your time. We've covered so much ground and really, really valued your perspectives and insights here. So thank you very much for sharing this. Look forward to having a chat with you again. And as the innovation hub establishes itself and begins to explore some of the other areas as well.
Thank you, Simon. This has been fantastic. And I look forward to coming back.
Thank you very much. So that's almost the show. If you liked what you heard tonight, spread the word. Follow us on Twitter. Feel free to get in touch. You can email me at simon@breakingbanks.com. Feel free to send through any tips or suggestions on people we should be interviewing or any other feedback so we can make this better. If you're listening and interested in sponsoring or coming on the show for that matter, just reach out. We've also got some really exciting guests lined up in November and December. So from me, have a great week, and I look forward to speaking to you all next week on Breaking Banks. Thank you.